Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 1999, and in the Creekside Room, Marcia Bungie is the presenter, and her subject will be Children, the Family, and Faith. And this session is entitled Contemporary Attitudes Towards Children, and this is 99-1. Let's go and listen to Marcia.
Yeah, I think we'll go ahead and get started. I guess they tape all these things so the guy can roll the tape. It's nice to see you. My name is Marcia Bungie. I teach at Valparaiso University at Christ College, which is the honors college of Valparaiso University. And I work with young people, of course, in the college, and also have a son, Isaac, and been concerned about a lot of the problems that our children are facing today in our country, but even worldwide. And for the last year, I've been directing a project called The Child and Christian Thought. And I've been gathering together about 17 scholars to examine what various theologians and movements in the past have said about children, the nature of children, and about our obligations to children, not just the church, not just the parents, but also the church and society. So it's been a very rewarding project. And we're hoping that our research will not only contribute to the history of conceptions of childhood, because there's a whole burgeoning literature just on how we have understood the nature of children in the past, so we hope that it contributes to that, but also contribute to our understanding of Christian thought and strengthen ethical and theological reflection about children today. So while at Holden, I'm sharing some of the findings of our research and prompting discussions about various issues related to children, such as sin and depravity in children, which is a big theme in theology, the vocation of parenting and what parenting means, the spiritual life of children, and child advocacy in the church. Now today, since my project on the child and Christian thought really explores the Christian tradition and the past in order to help inform the present, I thought that I'd start the series by talking a little bit about some of the problems that children are facing today, and then look at two theories about our present-day attitudes toward children that have contributed to these problems, and then look at resources that the church might offer that might help us create more positive attitudes toward children, and then finally to look at some possible changes that might result from more positive attitudes toward children. And I'd like to use my remarks, I'll talk about 20, 30 minutes, something like that, as a springboard for discussing our own concerns about problems that children are facing today, to look at some of your views about attitudes we have toward children, to understand and maybe think together about what are some theological resources we have in the tradition for thinking about children in more positive ways, that ways that will help us support children, and then look at some positive changes you would like to see happen, in relation to our children and in the family and in the church. Well, let me say just a few words about the situation of children today. I think because of the terrible tragedy in Littleton, we've all been thinking about very much in the media and newspapers about the situation of children today, because that event raised so many questions for us, such as why did the parents of the two killers know so little about what their children were doing? To what extent are parents responsible for the deeds of their children? How could minors own such powerful weapons? And what role did perhaps the video games, TV shows, and movies play in shaping the minds and actions of young people? So this terrible tragedy and the many other school shootings reveal just a few of the problems that our children are facing today in our country. And the National Commission on Children, the State of the World's Children, and the Children's Defense Fund provide us with a number of startling statistics about the situation of children today. And I'd just like to mention a few of these statistics. For example, and these are related to children in the United States, 1 in 5 children, so 20% of the children in this country, live in poverty. Whereas in 1970, about 10.5 million children lived in poverty. Today, the number has increased to about 14.5 million. 1 in 8 children in the United States goes to bed hungry. 1 in 2 children will live in a single parent family at some point in their childhood. And although the rates of teenage pregnancy are declining, which is a very positive sign, 1 in 8 children is still born to a teenage mother. American children under 15 are 12 times more likely to die from gunfire than children in 25 other industrialized countries combined. So that's, you know, 12 times more likely than the amount of children in 25 other industrial countries combined. Another way to state this is that 25 children in the United States, the equivalent of one classroom, are killed by guns every 2 days. And if you know the work of the Children's Defense Fund, this is a very strong theme in their work of the violence against children in our country. Rates of juvenile crime, drug and alcohol abuse, rates of juvenile suicide and depression continue to rise. A growing number of children seem to lack a strong sense of right and wrong, and many of them lack a sense of meaning or hope. The state of the children in worldwide is also quite alarming, and Stephen Lucey's report, in his report on child rights, says, the stories from children pour forth in an avalanche of horror. And just a couple of statistics here that, for example, over 1.5 million children worldwide have been killed by wars during just the past decade. And in many countries, children are literally torn to shreds by landmines and are being used as child labor. Now, even if we might disagree about the extent of these problems, and there's a discussion about, well, you know, children have always been in crisis, and we can look back in history, and it's always been a problem of the family, it's always been a problem of children. Nevertheless, there is growing consensus among liberal and conservative people that this is a concern for us, that we must really address these tremendous challenges that children are facing today. I think about my own experience, too. I'm a college professor. I'm working with very privileged, very bright kids. And even there, you see some of these problems arising among this group of highly privileged children. For example, we have a high rate, as many, many universities do, of binge drinking. And all of these colleges and universities are having to really address binge drinking and alcoholism in their colleges. I also have found, which was interesting for me, that although 90% of my students have grown up in Christian homes, 90% would say they are Christians and that they went to Sunday school. I'm always surprised how little they know about the Christian faith or the Bible, or how very little they can say about the relationship between faith and their everyday lives. Many of them have told me that they have never spoken with their parents about religious or spiritual issues. I teach religion, and it's always a bit clumsy teaching religion in classes because we think of religion as so private. It's something very private, very subjective. And so I thought, well, they must have discussed it somewhere. And I always have them fill out this little form. Where have you talked about religious issues? And many of them, not just a minority, say they have never even spoken about religious issues with their parents. Certainly many of these students in my school and others struggle with their identity. Some are expressed cynicism and have a kind of extreme kind of ethical relativism. So these drinking problems, this lack of understanding about the Christian tradition and a lot of these other issues have made me wonder, you know, what has taken place in the lives of these children before they came to college? What has been kind of the formation of their lives before they've come here? You know, has anybody been speaking to them about issues that matter to them? In what way have they been nourished spiritually and morally? In our college, we always talk about trying to form character, and that's part of the mission of these church-related colleges, that you want them to think critically and to write well. But you also talk about something about the formation of character in the person, and because we talk so much about that, you have to wonder what has happened, what kind of formation has taken place before this period. And I wonder, can parents or the church even have much of an influence on children if they are watching 26 or 27 hours of television a week, which is the average? And you think, wow, they've got that sort of 1 hour of Sunday school, you know, maybe twice a month, because sometimes you go to grandma, sometimes you do this. So, okay, we got about 2 hours maybe of Sunday school. How can that possibly compete with over 100 hours in a month of the media? Now, all of these challenges that children face today have caused theologians and others to raise the question, well, what are the causes of these problems, and what could the church do to address them? Are there aspects of the Christian tradition that can help us and be a resource for helping children today, and what concrete actions could the church take? So I want to look at just two theories proposed by some theologians who are exploring the causes of these problems. The one is Herbert Anderson, and he's a pastoral theologian in Chicago, and has written a lot on children, and Susan Johnson, and they together have written a book called Regarding Children, and if you're interested in bibliography, I can give you one at the end of the session. There's also another guy named Todd Whitmore, who teaches at Notre Dame, and he's written a very interesting article, too, about attitudes we have in our culture toward children. So I'd just like to go over their theories a little bit and the changes they think could happen in the church and in families if we adopted new attitudes to children. Because these theologians firmly believe that if we want to help children, we must change our attitude toward them. All three of them claim that part of the cause of these problems has to do with these very negative attitudes we have in our culture about children. And they see that the transformation of these negative attitudes to more positive ones is one of the most fundamental and urgent agendas of our time and one way to address these problems of children. Now, in their work, they offer slightly different descriptions of these negative attitudes we have toward children, and they also examine particular resources from the tradition. So I'd like to just look at what they say. Now, Anderson and Johnson, in their book Regarding Children, agree and think that the dominant attitude toward children we have in our culture is contempt or indifference. They would say that we have fostered a culture of indifference toward our children and that many adults disdain children. And you think, well, how can this be? We have all these wonderful, this emphasis politically about children. We have wonderful, cute clothes for kids. We seem to be a child-friendly kind of culture. But they say, using the work of a sociologist, Floyd Martinson, that there are three dominant expressions of this indifference or contempt for children. And the first is that we tend to view children as property, that children are the property of their parents and the parents have the sovereign rights, children have no rights. And he cites examples of battles for custody of children, in divorce battles, but also in adoption situations, that there we do tend to see children as property. He also says that we tend to view another expression of this contempt is that we see children as depraved. And I'll talk more about this tomorrow and the next day. But we often use this as the basis for justifying very harsh treatment against children. And you'll find this even today. It's a theme in the Christian tradition. It's not the only theme, but we tend to see, some theologians have tended to see children as sinful and depraved, and therefore you have to kind of literally beat the hell out of them. And we have quite a bit of evidence in the United States, in our kind of tradition in the United States religiously, of this kind of sense that if children are sinful, the way you break their will is to sort of beat it out of them. And there are really disturbing studies about that. Another expression of this contempt or indifference is that we tend to see children as incomplete, that they're not fully human, that because they don't have language or their reasoning abilities aren't fully developed, they're in some way not quite human beings. They're on their way there, but they're not quite human beings. And they say that when we look at children that way, sort of incomplete or not quite fully human, on the one hand, we tend to neglect children or ignore them. They're not as important as dealing with adults, so we don't need to deal with them. But on the other hand, when we view them this way, we become almost too child-centered. The children have sort of their own little world. They don't have responsibility. They're not yet human, and we don't have to give them responsibilities. And so they live in kind of a child-centered world that is also not good for children. Now, they would say the root cause of this indifference is that, and they refer to the work of a psychologist here who says, adults have contempt for children because adults don't want to accept their own vulnerability, their own needs, or their own weaknesses. That it's very difficult to accept our own weaknesses, our own needs, our own vulnerability, because we live in a culture that doesn't emphasize that. We live in a culture that emphasizes strength or size or self-sufficiency. And so it's kind of uncomfortable for adults. Another reason is simply that we're uncomfortable with our finitude and you see a child who's dependent and vulnerable, and we feel uncomfortable ourselves with that kind of finitude. So they think the way, what we need to do is transform the ways we think about children. We need to transform these attitudes. And they propose two kinds of attitudes we need to take up. And the first one is simply that we need to respect the full humanity of children. That we need to think that children already possess a kind of fullness of being human. They're not simply incomplete humans or sort of on the way. And that is kind of paradoxical because we certainly realize children are growing, they are developing, but that they say then we need to recognize this paradox that children are fully human, although what is present in the child is yet to be realized. So they want a sense of growth and development, but they also say this is kind of the main foundation on which we can really work if we want to change the situation of children. And then their second proposal is that in order to do this, we have to recognize one other thing, that the transformation towards this attitude of respect for children means that we have to begin with the recognition that in becoming adults, we do not lose our childhood. So, and we have to see just a minute what they mean by that. So they would say, in becoming adults, we do not lose our childhood. They say that the qualities of children that we maintain as adults and should recognize are things like this, that we are all always vulnerable, that we are all should have a kind of openness spiritually, and they see that in children. They're kind of open to the world and have a sense of wonder, and that's something we should all kind of maintain even as we become adults. Another quality is this quality of imagination and play, a kind of sense of immediacy, and that's something we should maintain and hold on to as adults as well. And finally, we must recognize we never outgrow our dependence. We are all finite beings and are all in some way dependent. And so they would say if we could kind of recognize that, we would have more respect for children and the humanity of children, and then we could make some very positive changes. Now they see the basis for these ideas in the New Testament and the sayings of Jesus, where Jesus, for example, welcomes the children and in order to touch them and bless them in a loving and healing way. In Mark, for example, there's a sense that children too have dignity and worth. So they pick up some passages from the New Testament to help support this idea. Now Whitmore has a little bit different idea about our attitudes toward children, but there's some overlap. He thinks that our attitude toward children is mainly shaped by the logic of capitalism. And he believes that this logic of capitalism is one of the main threats to children today because it shapes the way we understand who people are, including children. And here he's using capitalism as a normative term to designate societies where the market is unrestrained and thus extends to other spheres of civil society that results in an emphasis on material things over persons and an emphasis on individual self-interest over the common good. So we might disagree with and talk later on about this idea about capitalism, but let's just follow his argument to see what he says about how this logic informs our view of human persons, including children. He believes that this priority of things over people and self-interest over the common good carries with it a kind of view of the human person. And this view of the human person has kind of three dimensions. First of all, it tends to view people as a commodity, that we see people as instruments of production or things or products. We think about people and our relationship to them in terms of kind of cost-benefit analysis. And we start to see them as commodities, as kind of a means to an end instead of as having their own intrinsic worth or as having being ends in themselves. And you might ask, well, how do we see really children as commodities? And he brings this up in one example in our relationship to reproductive technologies, that this has become a really big industry. People invest a lot of money into these reproductive technologies in attempt to get a return for their investment, which is a quality child. And it's very hard sometimes for people to sort out their motives or to sort out all the options about, you know, what road you need to take. And there is a lot of language, even the way they advertise how, you know, what you get out of coming to this reproductive center has that kind of logic of capitalism. We also certainly see the view of children as commodities in labor practices, child labor practices, and sometimes in adoptive procedures. We also see this when we see parents who want to have children in order as kind of a means to an end, to kind of fulfill their own left behind dreams or feel their own kind of fantasies, that the child becomes in a way sort of a tool or a means to their own ends for fulfillment. The logic of capitalism also portrays the person as a consumer, and people have value insofar as they are purchasing commodities. So market advertising repeats unendingly to the person the message that if you do not buy or consume this good, then you do not have worth. So Whitmore believes this view of the person certainly applies to children today. He gives the example of television advertising for preschoolers. Preschoolers watch about 27 hours of television a week. And companies try to hook into this audience with a particular kind of advertising. The president of Nickelodeon, which has about 30% of the market share of programs for children, comments in regard to advertising for preschool children. And this is his quote. "By getting children to watch us at this age, we have them for life. And that's exactly what we are doing. And the key to hooking children into buying products and be better consumers is to have shows that feature toys as the characters. And you can't believe how products such as Ninja Turtles, Power Rangers, what a billion-dollar business this is. Last year they grossed a tremendous amount of money from this advertising that connected to these TV shows for preschoolers. I think certainly we see the notion of the child as consumer when we look at our teenagers or young people. Their lives are often focused around media consumption. Much of their time is devoted to television or movies or videos. My students at Valparaiso are so articulate about movies. They couldn't tell you four or five biblical characters, but they can tell you just about every movie that they've seen, and they're very articulate about speaking about movies. It's much harder for them to speak about novels than it is for them to speak about characters in movies, for example. One of my students told me that she kind of sees her lives, and she was critiquing her own life, as a kind of myriad of entertainment events, that she's always looking for this kind of, they're waiting to go to some event where they're going to go to some, you know, park, or they're going to go to some movie. That her life, she thought, is kind of focused around these entertainment events, around consumerist opportunities. And young people are also very tempted to remake themselves, certainly, in relation to fads on television or certain marketing products. So I think we could see this example of seeing children as consumers, certainly, even if we didn't agree completely with everything what Whitman said. Finally, he says that people who are not commodities or consumers are simply seen in the logic of capitalism as burdens, that if people cannot produce or they cannot consume, then they're seen as burdens. They have no worth at all. They have no intrinsic dignity. And this is particularly the case with poor children. When children are neither consumers or high-quality children, they are non-entities and their claims for recognition are understood as burdens. I think you can even kind of see this logic in the way people talk about how many children they're going to have. A lot of times it's this kind of cost-benefit analysis that sort of seeps into the discussion. Or in adoption procedures, there's a whole range of kind of options you have when you adopt. You can get a special needs child for practically nothing, but you want a healthy baby, that's going to cost you about $20,000. And so you have to start thinking about, well, gee, now what's the cost benefit of this? Is it going to give me that much pleasure, the $20,000 kid? And it kind of just seeps into our logic, consciously and unconsciously. Even if we don't all agree that these are perhaps the dominant attitudes for our children, I think it's hard not to agree with Whitmore and others that consumerism and cost-benefit analysis has really permeated the way we think about the world, about our relationships to people, and that also includes children. Well, what resources does Whitmore see for changing this kind of attitude toward children? And he's a Catholic, and he's kind of disturbed that the Catholic tradition hardly has any teaching about children. He said, basically, we have these many statements on the family, and the Catholics are really great with this. They have a lot of programs for families. But he said, when you start looking at these statements and these documents about the family, all they really say about kids is you should educate them in the faith, and they should obey their parents. And that's about it. We don't really have a teaching about children like we have a teaching about our view of war or our teaching about abortion. A lot more emphasis has been given to the teaching about abortion than just about children. But he says maybe by looking at Catholic social teaching, so he wants to kind of pick up some Catholic themes, that maybe we could have some different perspectives on children and have a beginning for a strong teaching in the church about children. And the basis for his views, kind of a new, is the anthropology of the Catholic social teaching generally, that comes from Thomas Aquinas and his notion that all beings come from and are destined to return to God. So that's kind of the basic vision, that all beings are from and are destined to return to God, as kind of the broad vision of how we start to view children. And then in relation to children, he becomes very particular, and he says instead of viewing them as commodities, we need to view them as gifts of God, made in the image of God. These gifts are made in the image of God, not in our image. And maybe this would help take away this focus on children as sort of commodities made in our image, or the kind of image we want, if we can focus on them as gifts of God, made in the image of God. He also wants to see children not as consumers, but as signs of hope. That children are signs of the future that extend beyond self-interested desires of others. And this future is a future that's leading toward God. And that he thinks this might help relativize this kind of the immediate wants of adults in relationship to children and see them more as sort of these signs of hope. And then finally, he says that if we can see children as gifts of God, made in the image of God, and as signs of hope, then it will kind of call us to love in the form of present responsibility towards children and have a much greater sense of responsibility toward children in the church. Now, all authors would say that if we could look at children in these ways, start to respect their full humanity, to start to see that in becoming adults we do not lose our own childhood, to see children as gifts of God and as signs of hope, then we might see some very positive changes in relationship to our children, in the family, and also in the church. And I'll just mention a couple things and then we'll open it up for discussion. They're sort of saying if we can take up these attitudes, then we would see a lot of changes taking place in our relationship to children. If we started to see them as fully human, we might go at their pace a little bit more. We might have a lot more empathy for them. If we see that we're all in some way have these qualities and should have these qualities of childhood, then we would have more compassion for children. We might listen to children more. And I thought that was a very interesting point in this whole discussion on Littleton. They had quite a few panel discussions on public radio with some young people. And one of the things that they kept saying was, parents don't listen to us. We don't have really a chance to talk to our parents. And if they could just listen, we could have a richer conversation. This would do a lot to help us out. And I see that even again in my own very privileged students who come from very nice background. They say too, they really haven't had much opportunity to know much about their own parents' values or to speak with them. So maybe some of that would change. We might also see some changes in the family if we took up these kind of attitudes toward children. Johnson and Anderson would like to see the family become more hospitable, and see the family as kind of a hospitable community where we honor the otherness of someone, including the otherness of our children, to kind of see them almost as strangers and as someone other who is coming to our home. That maybe that would help us give more space for children. It might help us listen more to our children. They'd also like to see the family become more compassionate. If we took up these attitudes, that we would become more compassionate for the vulnerable and for those in need. They'd also like to see the family become a more just community, that if we saw children as fully human, we might treat them with more equal regard and treat them as kind of equal, with equal respect and consideration, and with more justice in our families. And that the family taking up these attitudes might become a more reconciling community, a more healing community, where we can promote forgiveness and healing. I think I'd like to add too that if we took up these attitudes toward children, we also might see the family becoming a teaching and worshiping community, where we would maybe start talking more about our own values and actually teaching more about the Christian tradition, and also worshiping together. If you've had any exposure to the Search Institute studies or the Youth and Family Institute at Augsburg, they have said that one of the main important ways to form children spiritually and morally is in the family. And they think we've kind of said, well, the church is taking care of their spiritual formation, we don't really need to do that. And they are just adamant. They have a lot of studies that show the importance of this, that families need to do a lot more teaching, a lot more worshiping together in their home, and that's the way to help form children morally and spiritually. We might also see some changes in the church. All the authors are kind of disappointed we don't have a stronger teaching in the church about children, and that a lot of times we do not really welcome children into the church. Maybe you've been in churches too where they haven't had even a very adequate educational program. I know in one church I was at, we had so much trouble just getting teachers. And then when we did get the teachers, we had some material, and it was really, I have to say, terrible material, terrible curriculum. And we'd have these meetings with these teachers who kind of struggled and made a lot of time to be the teacher of the Sunday school, and they said, I cannot use 3 out of 4 of these lessons. They're either not addressed to these children, or they don't have the right kind of, kind of a weak theology even in some of these materials. There are good materials out there, but it was sad that in the church, you know, we didn't really have access to that. We needed to do a lot more work. So maybe we'd see some changes in the church if we took up these attitudes toward children. We might welcome children more in worship and programs. We might give them meaningful jobs in the church, help them participate in worship. We might also support parents and others in raising children. Maybe support the vocation of the parent by speaking more about it, by having adult forums about the vocation of parenting. We would do more to have stronger Sunday school materials and to lift up those volunteers who do teach the Sunday school. We also might emphasize Bible study a little bit more. One of the, there's an interesting book, this Is It a Lost Cause by Marva Dawn. She talks about children in the church, and she says, one of the things she thinks is quite important is to have more biblical stories and stories about saints in the church, people we lift up within the tradition for our children, because they don't have any more stories that are shaping their lives. There, again, this kind of myriad of consumer kind of video is what's informing their lives. I have this little 5-year-old, and I am just amazed. We don't watch that much TV at all. I would say maybe an hour a week. And we don't have watch much videos, but it's very interesting. He knows what products are out there. And he knows this. He's never seen Power Rangers. He knows a lot about Power Rangers. Somehow, the Ninja Turtles, he's never seen that. So there's something about being able to, put more stories from the tradition and more stories about people in the tradition into these children's lives that would be important for the church. And we might also help care for people in crisis, for families in crisis, whether through divorce or through death in the family. We might take that more urgently if we saw children in these ways. Well, These are just two theories about the attitudes to children and positive changes that might occur if we had these attitudes. Certainly there are many other perspectives about the root causes of a lot of the problems children are facing today. But these authors believe that a change in our attitude to children based on the Gospels or on the teachings of the Church could help us improve the lives of our children. And certainly I think we all need to be more alert to the needs of children and become much more deliberate about nurturing them in some of the ways I've suggested. So now I'd just like to open up the discussion, and I'd like to hear your comments about your own experience with the situation of children, or some of your ideas about attitudes we have toward children. Maybe challenge some of these theories and add your own, and talk about some of the positive resources from our tradition that might help us think in a little different way about children. What are some of the theological foundations we could have for a strong support of children? And what changes would you like to see happening in the church and in the family in relation to children?
I have a quick question. What's your definition of child? What sort of age group?
Yeah, mainly, and that's a very good question. It kind of includes young adults, so it would be like up to 18.
Okay.
So, and that's been kind of an interesting part of our study too, just how you define children and childhood and the stages, what is really an adult and what is a child. But in more of the contemporary literature, it's kind of to 18 is what we kind of define as a child. What other thoughts do you have? What concerns maybe do you have?
One of the things, I am in a rural parish, in a sense, in Port Angeles, which is kind of a self-contained, it's not exactly suburbia, but it has a lot of suburban mentality to it. And they would fight tooth and nail the understanding that we treat our children with contempt and indifference because they're busy about giving their children every advantage. And part of it, I think, is even in the definition of family, that at least I see part of the role of the church as helping them to understand family in a much larger context. Because as they try to advantage their children, they then end up treating with contempt and indifference all other children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I see that in terms of the flight from the public schools, moving increasingly to class distinctions in order to advantage my children.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, how we get a larger frame for people to understand what it is they're giving their children.
Mm-hmm. Right, and trying to see all children as worthy of our attention. And that's kind of, maybe, again, seeing children as gifts of God, in the image of God. They're all made in the image of God. Maybe that's one way to break through that. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting because you'd say, well, of course we don't treat our children with contempt. But, again, like you say, it's kind of a division. Because if you just look at the behavior of our nation and that 1 in 5 children is in poverty, that is just a condemning statistic. That shows, and that's kind of the proof that Johnson and give, that we must have contempt for our children. That maybe we don't have contempt for our biological children, like you say, but it's for our adopted children, but the children in our midst. So that's a very good distinction, because you look at the Baby Gap commercials, you look at all these opportunities for young kids, and you think, of course we don't live in a culture of contempt for children. We love children, we're very child-centered, but it's maybe child-centered on only our children.
Well, and I think it gets into part of it is over in the other thing in terms of the of their living their lives through their children. I mean, why we invest so much in them is so that they will, I suppose, not disgrace us,
mm-hmm.
or bring some honor to. It's a very, very fascinating dynamic.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to show my age here, but. It seems to me that we don't expect enough as far as responsibility is concerned many times with our children when we're trying to advantage them and take them to every soccer and dance and piano recital and basketball game, and just very seldom expect children to have responsibility. I also don't think we put them in risky situations enough, like we have to protect them. And we took our kids into inner city Washington, D.C. for 8 years, and then into an abandoned mine and burn, and then that was the third move. The other one was into the hills of West Virginia, where the education was absolutely terrible, and where we had to work kind of, it was a survival mentality. And I, at first, I felt really guilty when my kids were finally in college. You know, oh, what did I do to these children? I took them to the inner city, D.C., where the risks were terrible and the school was bad, and I took them to West Virginia. And yet, I think they're great kids. What they learned, they learned to get along with all kinds of people. They learned that material things weren't the most important things in life. I mean, I'll have to ask my kids again, but they've always said that they were glad for those experiences. Mm-hmm. But I see sometimes even grandchildren kind of almost babied, or like we dare not risk putting them in a situation where they might not be able to handle it. And I don't know.
Yeah. I think that's very much connected with this kind of respect for their humanity. That, you know, we don't want them to do that yet because they're not old enough. But a lot of studies, there's a guy named Damon, D-A-M-O-N, who's written a lot of books on, which is what you're speaking about, with this responsibility. We don't give enough responsibility to children. They live in a very, a kind of culture where they want immediate gratification, and that delayed gratification is about one of the most important things you can learn to be in good relations with people, to be a good citizen, to get along in life. And they're not learning that because they live in a very child-centered, even among my friends, there's a lot of children don't have any chores. No chores, nothing. Because it's easier for the parents to do it themselves. They don't want to have to bother with it. But I think that idea of bringing more responsibility to children and having consequences and allowing them to take a few more risks is really important.
And that's kind of on a fine line, because as a parent then, you wonder, you're letting them take risks, but are you subjecting yourself to judgment of others for allowing them to take those risks? Are you then viewed as a neglected parent by saying, you're putting those in those circumstances, mm-hmm. where they are, you know, stepping out maybe beyond your comfort zone as well as the child's?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of interesting. I'm teaching at a college, and some of the rest of you are teaching too at universities. The counselors at the colleges have said it's quite difficult right now for some students to accept disappointment or to accept critique of their work. That it's really a very startling problem. And part of this is they think they've constantly been monitored. They've been at these, like, soccer games, or where there's constantly kind of an event for children created with adults, and that they don't really have a sense of creating their own kind of play or a sense of responsibility, or it's always supposed to be so supporting their self-esteem, we don't allow for critique. So I think that's kind of an interesting problem. That we have a lot of students, and some of you at other universities and colleges might share your experiences there, but it's very difficult, this delayed gratification or critique. And really having a schedule they can follow, because they've been kind of given a schedule of things they are to do with their parents. But it is a fine line.
Are there any class differences? Because it sounds like my experience is very similar to yours in terms of dealing with students who are predominantly white, predominantly upper middle class. And so it seems to me as if the kids in those sorts of families will have particular sorts of parents who are pushing them for success, and so I'm wondering if there are class differences in terms of the sorts of childhood that a child might experience. Does that
make sense? Oh yes. And that's a very good point, and maybe we could start talking about some of that, because now these people would say we kind of slip them into the burdens of how we're supposed to deal with these kind of students. And even sometimes at universities, you can see them almost as burdens. I see quite a difference between not so much race in my college, but more between class. Parents whose parents have been to college, they know what it's about, they've gotten a lot of support, and children whose parents couldn't care less. They lived in a very chaotic environment. One of my students, who comes from a very low-income group, she had to take care of her, I guess they would be her cousins, because her aunt left the children. It was an abusive father. It was a terribly chaotic situation. She gets no support from her family. So sometimes that scene is good, you know, but we sometimes think about diversity in the universities as more class, more racial diversity, but not so much class. I think class is really very significant, and we shouldn't see those students as sort of burdens on the system, because we got to put a lot more input into them. We got to help them out a lot more.
See, what I was thinking was that children who might be in the lower classes might tend within their families to be treated with actually more respect instead of being treated as the children and the adults.
Yeah.
Is that a possible
reason? But and also they might have been put too soon into an adult
responsibility.
Like this one woman I'm speaking about, she was too young to really take care of all those children. She got a lot out of it. She's a very competent boy. She turns in everything on time, highly responsible. But she said it was kind of difficult in that sense. So I think it could kind of work both ways.
I spend a lot of my time working with high schoolers, and boy, Whitmore's evaluation just rings so true with what I see and what I talk with my kids about. To talk about that we are created in God's image, and what part of God might you be embodying in this world, that is such a difficult conversation to have right now with high schoolers, because I believe our young people are targeted, and I think that it is violence almost. They are targeted as consumers, and it doesn't matter who you are, it matters what you wear. And so, you know, to talk with kids about who are you, who do you want to be, They don't know. They don't know how to talk about what gifts they've been given, but they can tell you, or they can tell me what they'll major in because they can make money.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you want to do it? I don't know, but I'll make money.
Right, and it seems like such an uphill battle, doesn't it? When I just look at those decisions about watching television, I mean, just that in itself, all the time given in a kid's life, they say they watch more television in their lifetime than they are in a classroom. Excuse me, up to 18, the children are watching more television than they are actually in a classroom over those 18 years. So it's kind of amazing, isn't it? I mean, where do we even get the time? Even if we said, oh, it doesn't matter so much, they're watching TV. It's taking a lot of the time. It's taking a lot of their resources. Those are the stories handed down to them. How are they hearing the stories that are important to us? And it is really striking to me when I have these students who say they have come from a, you know, highly Christian background. They cannot tell me the stories. I write down, you know, I have this little sort of quiz at the beginning just to make sure I'm not overly judgmental or something like that, or, you know, exaggerating this. But some of them don't know the story of the Exodus. I mean, one of my colleagues, he likes to see if anybody can name five biblical figures. And then they can come into the sort of stronger intro to the Bible. And he says very few students can do it. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? When they can rattle off the movie stars, they can rattle off all kinds of characters in movies, but they cannot rattle off the characters that we've said, or like, you know, not just biblical stories, but maybe stories of saints or stories of people we really kind of held in esteem that we want to model and be, and kind of see as our own examples in our lives. I don't know.
Haven't children been taught some of that in Sunday school and confirmation?
Well, I'll tell you.
If they're there.
I'm from San Marcos, Texas. We came up here a long way, and I've got six high schoolers with us right now. Mm-hmm. And one thing that we've discovered in our church, and I teach the high school group, it's one of the reasons we're down here. We've worked 2 years to come up to Seattle, and through members in our church. I just want to say that it was through donations through our church, these very wonderful people that, you know, allowed us to be able to come here, along with raising money. But the church was very supportive. But what we've discovered is that the high school youth, it is an entertainee. Mm-hmm. That's this Generation Y or whatever they want to call it. You know, the whole, they've grown up with all of this constant, you know, information blasted in their faces, and it's kind of an entertainee. So what we've discovered in our own high school class is that we're trying very desperately to incorporate the stories, but we found the traditional way does not work. We are having to make it work in a kind of entertainment type situation. I don't know, it's a real fine line whether that's really okay or not. Mm-hmm. We're trying somehow to get their attention, to be able to sit down and talk to them, whether through videos or discussions. But it's mm-hmm. such a materialistic, mm-hmm. it's what you wear, what you, you know.
And if they're only spending a couple hours a month.
Yes, we work very hard to have
that. Even if they go every Sunday, four mm-hmm. hours a month, yeah. and you're spending hundreds of watching TV.
Yeah. We live in a small community, so we're able to do a lot of activities throughout the month. But mm-hmm. even then, I don't know, we are struggling. I mean, they came up here, and it's hard. It was 10:30, 11 o'clock. Quiet. I mean, everything was on the boat right up here. Go faster, go faster. You know, mm-hmm. I speak to Mr. Libby. Why can't that boat go faster? And so this has been really wonderful, and I know it's going to take them a few days to mm-hmm. to get calm. But they're just, I mean, we had two boys that went straight up the mountain, not even on a trail yesterday, and just, you know, and it's the society that we live in, and it's just, you know, everything is how fast can it go, how soon can I get it, immediate gratification. And which is why I'm so glad to hear. So I just need to say that. But
yeah, just being this alternative place where there is not a television. What a statement, you know, because now they even have televisions in planes and in the airport. Yeah, there is no place. It's so bizarre. In cars, they want you to watch videos, which, like this Search Institute, or is this Youth Man? I can't remember
Peter
which
Benson.
One did it. But
Peter,
they have.
Peter Benson.
Yeah, they have these. They want people to speak in the car. They think that's sort of one safer place where the telephone isn't ringing, where the TV isn't on. So let's do a lot of quality talking about our faith or about, you know, your vans in the car. And I saw that now they have in those minivans,
yeah.
you know, the little video. And you can have different things, too. You can do one in the front seat for the parents, you know, listening. They can't watch the video. And then the kids can be in the back watching the videos. We can't even share speaking about the videos in the car. So it is kind of an uphill battle.
We went up the boat to Lake Chelan, and our kids are either sleeping or with their CD walkers on in this beautiful scenery. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
how do we, you know?
We know one thing. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's the beautiful thing about coming to Holden on staff. Everything you do in this village, winter and summer, you create and do yourself. Mm-hmm. Whether it's drama or music or biblical study, or I mean, it's just a whole new way of thinking and learning to entertain yourself, and it's done in community. It's not an
individual. Yeah, but don't get too romantic about that, Mary. I mean, so right in that cabinet behind those doors is a video.
Isn't that for teaching?
No. I came in here the other day, and there were kids watching a cartoon thing, and during the winter, you know as well as I do that there's a video on Friday night or Saturday night, and there are chalets all around here with long-term winter staff that have huge video libraries, and they run them back and forth. So, I mean, it isn't. We shouldn't romanticize Holden. It was certainly the case more so in the early 80s when you were here.
Just half
I know, not under your watch. But, yeah.
Well, I think part of it is that at a young age, children, they don't know how to play anymore. They have not learned how to play. And so I think that's really a lot of the problem. At a young age, they have to go and learn how to play.
We don't let them play.
We don't let them compete. Yeah. Right. They don't just know how to. You used to be, you go out and you find your neighbors and you start a baseball game or whatever, but you go and you find something to do. And now it's like, okay, we got to go to soccer here, we got to go do this here. And there's no kids around for the other kids to play with. Mm-hmm. There's nobody around to just, you know, get together with and figure out something to do, to entertain yourself.
But then as parents, I'm not a parent, so I maybe can't even say, but our parents are, the parents are letting the kids do this. The parents are signing them up for soccer.
Yeah, they're organizing.
Signing them up for dance, signing them up for whatever. I mean, the parents need to.
I think it's really important how we use the word learn, because our children, they are learning what we are teaching. And so, you know, they aren't learning to play. I don't think that's where we start. We aren't teaching how to play.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm. I remember.
We're giving them those opportunities just to try it out.
You were just talking about, you know, coming up in the boat and the kids all sitting there with their headsets and so forth and not paying any attention. But I remember when we took that young man and his brothers and sisters on a trip to the West Coast when he was 13, 14 years old. And my husband and I are sitting there saying, oh, look at that, oh, look at that, oh, look at that. And we've got four teenagers in the backseat, and that was before the days of having a video machine or TV in the, you know, in the car or anything. It's part of it's just being a teenager. I mean, they think, and we finally decided, that they think that they've got another chance at it. You know, that someday, right, Steve? That someday they will make that.
But you know, it's those baseline experiences that give you the jumping point. And you know, I hear sports and all this stuff being kind of taken a shot at here, even if it's tongue in cheek. And I think exposing your kids to elements that can build their character outside of the family is good. I've heard Sunday mornings for only 2 hours. Well, what about the reinforcement of the parents the other 7 days of the week?
Yeah,
you know,
well, that's very good. Yeah. Well,
and I think, you know, a consumerist society, yeah, I think you got to define what success is, number one, for your children.
Mm-hmm.
Or let them help define what success is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from the Industrial Revolution, when everything became mass-produced and we started looking at marketing as a form of increasing our sales, we've had to market to people, individuals, groups, niches now. And as such, you raise the level. And in doing so, you've got an expectation, delayed gratification, nothing. I mean, that's, you know, when you, if you don't produce, I see myself aligning more with Whitmore here. If you don't produce where you fit in here, well, there's an expectation that, you know, whether you're in poverty, moving out of the slums into an apartment that you can be self-sufficient in and off welfare, or whether you're a kid who moves out of a 30-room mansion and his idea is to retire in Florida with a yacht. Everybody is trying to take it to that next step. I mean, it's that carrot that's dangling out there, and that is our definition of success.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe challenging, you know, the notion of success. And I think you thought about sports, you know, being good in some way, it can be very good. People talk about you learn teamwork, you learn responsibility, you got to be there on time, you got to, you know, there is some delayed gratification there too. You got to wait or you've got to help out with something. So I think in proportion, it could be very good in a kind of set within a larger life. It's very, very positive.
And there's no TV.
But when it becomes, like you say, the maybe definition of how you're a good kid or that's success, but when you're, you know, highly, we have people with four-year-olds that are already got to have that soccer kid, got to have that kid be the best in soccer, and are disappointed when their kids do not do the best in soccer. That is really something.